afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, in this recording, we are recording episode 160, believe it or not. It's a 2.5 year old channel, and you know, I can't believe I'm saying 160 episode. Where does time go when you're having fun? I guess that's the question. The episode, the channel, it's been gaining a lot of good momentum lately. For the past 3 months, we've been averaging close to 1,500 downloads per day, 60,000 downloads, approaching 70 now for the past 60 days, and 2.5 million views on all platforms across many countries out there. So I want to thank you all for joining me in on this recording, on this episode with my guest of honor. We'll get to know Wynn Schwarto shortly. I'll let Wynn tell his story, my famous question at the beginning of every episode. So we want to get to know you to start with there, Wynn. Everybody comes on this channel has to answer this question. Everybody's got a story. So why don't we start with this? What's your story? What got you here?
You know, everybody that's in security, cybersecurity, or some related field got here through some convoluted path. There was no direct path. I used to be a recording engineer and producer. My father was, my mother was, so I grew up in that field. And then I burned out, completely fried, and said, no more rock and roll. And got involved with computers. And I was already an analog engineer. And then this digital stuff, oh, that's easy. That's easy shit. And one day, a company you may have heard of called Western Digital.
Contacted
a friend of mine. We were drinking buddies out in San Diego. And he goes, what do you know about security? And I go, what do I need to know? He goes, well, Western Digital has this project. And I said, good, I'll do it. No clue whatsoever. But it gave me the bug. And I've been doing it ever since. And did strictly cybersecurity exclusively through roughly 2017. So that was, 40 years of that, I guess. And now I've been migrating into attempting to build a new field of cognitive security.
Very impressive. Now, for the audience, Wynn has spent 4 decades mapping how information becomes a weapon. He coined the phrase electronic Pearl Harbor in 1991. Sorry, Wynn, I was doing a little bit of research on you, so hopefully you don't mind. And helped define information warfare and how. And now he argues that the real battlefield is in cognitive. So why don't we start with this? You've warned about electronic Pearl Harbor more than 30 years ago. Looking at today's landscape, was the threat misunderstood or was it simply ignored?
The semantics, the terminology of electronic Pearl Harbor didn't go over very well. Back in 91, there was a period of years where I was Chicken Little. You're overstating the problem. It's not that bad. Security and all that. So some people decided to get hung up on the semantics of the term Pearl Harbor. But when you really look at Pearl Harbor, it was a kinetic event, long-term planning, stealthy, quiet, until bang. So under that premise, a cyber Pearl Harbor, we've probably experienced a lot of them. Individual companies have experienced them. What is a blackout that takes out half of Canada, half of the northeast of the U.S.? That is a cyber electronic Pearl Harbor event. It was not the attack and all that. And God, I remember CNN called me up on that one. And they said, well, who are the terrorists behind this? And I said, it's a tree in Ohio. How do you know that? Because I know the old 1920s power grid. So some people get hung up on the term Pearl Harbor. And I'm working on a new book called Cognitive Pearl Harbors, in fact. If I get their attention and we have the discussion, that's what's important. Back in the early 90s, the lack of education, what we call now the awareness of the cybers, it was virtually non-existent, similar to what we're experiencing today when we try to talk about cognitives. It's a whole new area that people are not familiar with and also makes them very, very uncomfortable. So for me, it's a rinse and repeat. Did a Pearl Harbor electronic one affect the entire United States yet? No. However, when we look at some of the alleged attacks by adversaries against portions of our critical infrastructures, I tend to side with the folks that believe that they are embedded in some of our critical infrastructures, and if it really came down to it, pushing a couple buttons here and there can do stuff. A cognitive Pearl Harbor can also be individual. It can also be a sudden epiphany, a religious event, a political switch, a sudden awareness of something. And that can happen at the personal level, it can happen at the corporate level, and it can happen at the societal level as well. So I'm going to stick with my term, and if people want to go all pedantic on me, please go have a conversation. And when you all agree, come on back. I'm not going to go down the pedantic line on that. I use the word. I use the phrase.
That's right. Now, what do you mean by cognitive when it comes to cybersecurity? Can you explain that?
I've always looked at the world in terms of systems, whether it's the planets orbiting a sun, which orbits this, and how does this tie together in the audio industry? How do you get the microphones and the speakers and the audio and the systems all working? In networking, it's the same sort of stuff. How do we get all this stuff to work? Sometimes it works and it's great. And then sometimes it comes crashing down, either from internal oopses, errors, internal bad actors, or perhaps external bad actors. We are a system. We are an OODA loop, just like every other system known to man. We are influenced through our sensory inputs, whether you call it the five senses, six senses, or the Heinz 57 of senses. Again, that gets into the pedantics of it. We are the sum of our internal experiences as represented through the translation of external sensory perception and what we do with it inside. That creates our identity, our sense of self, how we view the world, sense of beliefs, if we have any beliefs at all. And when you start messing with those through an OODA loop, for example, every time a teenager or anybody gets a like on a social media, they get a little rush. They get a feel-good chemical rush. And that reinforces behavior, that reinforces beliefs, it reinforces the cognition of the individual at that particular time. In my mind, this is identical to physics and to networks. And if you look at it as well from a biological standpoint, we still have layers of systems, layers of protections. And so I've been working at trying to bridge all of those understandings into more of a coherent framework so we can get stakeholders from different expertises to talk to each other instead of being siloed and talking against each other.
So where are you on the book now? What stage are you in?
Which one? MetaWar is done.
And
MetaWar, the response to it has been really profound. I expected a lot more pushback for a lot of the things that I said. And it's been 95% positive with, I positioned it as here's just, thinking, here's where we're going to, let's start somewhere. Nobody else has done it. So I'm going to put a stake in the ground and let's talk around these issues. And in the last 2 years, cognitive security industry, I'm using that term very loosely here, there's been a lot of traction. There's been a lot of activity going on, but it hasn't coalesced yet with the center of gravity. My new book that I'm working on is called Cognitive Pearl Harbors, and it's going to be a collection of essays by experts, if you will, in various disciplines, from the legal to the philosophical to the neuro guys to the cyber guys. So very little of it is me. I'm doing the introduction. I'm setting it all up. Here's what I think. And now let's go to the experts. And so that hopefully will be out in the not too distant future.
Do you think cognitive warfare is a natural evolution of cyber warfare, or is it fundamentally a new domain?
All right, now we got to take two different views of the universe. You got to take the US view, then you got to take the rest of the world's view. In the EU/UK, over a 10-year period, they committed 140 billion euros to various types of cognitive defense, whether it's at the societal, personal level, whether it's in the educational system, whether it is at the military doctrinal level, at the NATO level. They've got 140 billion euros invested in this because they know that this is an ongoing battlefield. In the United States, the sum total is damn close to zero. So when you look at it from the dedication, awareness of who's looking at the problem, we're ignoring it. And I'm not going to get into any of the politics. I'm not going to, because a lot of that is self-evident. An awful lot of it I've spelled out in my books as to how and why it occurred. It bothers the hell out of me that I get so much more actionable interaction and with people out of Europe, Finland, England, all over, you know, 20 different countries I tend to deal with over there. So we have chosen not to embrace critical thinking, critical ignoring, all of those things that create a strong mental immune system. We've chosen very consciously to ignore it and blame it on the other guys.
So in, you know, like in just trying to make it easy for the audience to understand, if an electronic Pearl Harbor was about disabling system, what would be the equivalent of a failure in a cognitive war?
Election interference, social media interference, AI-driven bots with not misinformation or disinformation. I avoid those terms. I umbrellaed them all under BS, just bullshit. No matter what it is, clickbait, anything. It's the crap that's out there. And that type of cognitive warfare was outlined very, very specifically in a book by in 1984 called Love Letter to America by an ex-KGB propagandist, and he outlines exactly how to influence and take over the minds of other countries around the world, and he lays out the steps exactly, and it is scarier in hell. It's an 80-page pamphlet, and I really suggest people read Love Letter to America by Yuri Bezmenov. It'll scare the hell out of you.
We got to put that context in the post-edit here for the audience to check it out as a document to read or as a book to read. I've heard about that. You know what? I've heard about that book. I think they made it into a book. Am I correct? I've heard of it, though.
Originally, it was Yuri Bezmenov was a KGB guy and all that stuff. And at one point, I forget what year, he defected, but he defected to Canada. And he had a Canadian name, which does not, well, Western name, that doesn't, I don't have it in my head right now. So he published it originally under the Western pseudonym, and then shortly thereafter did some YouTube videos. There's some excellent YouTubes with Yuri Bezmenov talking about his work in destabilization through cognitive warfare. And NATO is highly aware of this. The European countries are highly aware of it, and that's why they're spending tens of billions of euros on defensive postures.
Yeah. Now, where do you stand on the AI systems and the implication of those systems for what you're talking about, like the meta war and the cognitive one? How does AI fit into all this?
They are a great, great attack weapons. They're great because you don't care what the output is. You just care that how it's influencing your target audience. So it can be, and all my lights are flickering for some reason. I have no idea why.
Because you and I were talking, there's some attack on you now.
Oh, this is really weird. I've never seen my light panels do that before. So maybe it's a UAP up there. Remind me of the question. I got distracted by these lights.
No, I was wondering about the AI system. How is the AI system?
The more BS that's out there, whether it's just pure noise or whether it's targeted noise or it's targeted narrative manipulation and messaging, it's a force multiplier. And to use a military term. And right now, social media cares about making money, not about doing an adequate job of identity management and filtering. Again, without getting political or what's true or not true, I am really in favor of verification that there is a human behind every identity. And that is not a money-making proposal for social media. So AI, they're going to use the bejesus out of it and we're going to try to defend against it. And so you're seeing perhaps the BS detectors. There's stuff that's coming out and warnings. We were familiar with the web of trust in our browser. It's getting you an 83. No, don't go there. or your malware detection tells you or your spam phone. It's all about detection reaction systems and AI versus AI. We're not doing all that well right now, and especially because the distributors are in it for money.
You know what? I've seen some channels tagging things that it was AI produced, or they forced the creator. Like, let's say when I upload something to YouTube, it tells me, it asks me specifically, like, the question, has this content been altered? And if you answer yes, then it shows up that it's been synthetically edited video or content of any sort. But yeah, I agree with you. Like, just on a personal level, my wife and I and family, we watch sometimes YouTube videos or any other content we consume online. It's very hard to decipher lately if it's general content produced by a human.
We watch cat videos.
That's okay.
The same thing. Is that real? And you go, The problem is that carries over to the rest of our lives when things matter.
That's fine. That's okay.
I have no idea. Whatever.
So, you know, it goes back to, you know, deciphering what is true and what is not true. And specifically, like, the age group that you're trying to, that these contents are targeting, because a lot of youngsters or young people in general, they're a little bit more vulnerable to believing that this content is true versus as mature adult now, you ask question, you wonder if this is true or not. So the impact on various generation is at a various different levels from, you know, the depends on the age group that you belong to. It could have various impacts on how you view things.
It's the age group and also technical or security, privacy, awareness, nothing else. And I guess 2 years ago, I started printing up stickers. Trust nothing. Verify twice.
That's right.
And it's taken a lot more time, but that's why I've also gotten working on critical ignoring as a skill, because there is too much information out there for our poor, very limited senses and our sensory systems. And we are being, in cybersecurity terms, we are being DDoSed every single day. And the ramifications of that are inability to make decisions, poor decision making, mental health problems, and radical conversion into alternate belief systems.
And people are building their own universe based on fundamentally wrong information.
Getting people to agree, when they introduce that term alternate fact, to this day, I have talked to a lot of people professionally, and then of course, you know, in bar conversations, what the hell is an alternate fact? Well, the sun's over there, it's 93 million miles away. Cool. Now, what is the alternate fact to that? I don't know. As growing up as a geek in science and engineering, we come to have a pretty good way of estimating the efficacy and likelihood that the fact is a fact, subject to some radical change down the line that we cannot anticipate. Alternate fact is not, I cannot wrap my head around it.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you know, this is called the localized fireside chat. We talk a lot about languages, we talk a lot about AI, and we talk about advancement in a variety of things. How does language impact your thinking or your research in the cognitive world that we're talking about today?
I say that it's less about language and more about culture.
Huh?
When in Europe, in Western Europe, we are all in complete sync. We understand. And I'm going to give a shout out to my friends in the Netherlands. They have been a great sounding board and friends for almost 40 years. And when I have a crazy idea, I go over there and they'll be brutally honest with me. And I love it. When I have spoken and done work in other cultures, I am often met with the crickets, the silence. And whether that's because I'm outspoken and loud American, they don't like the message, it's contrary to the political system that exists, whatever they're, but it is, I think it's more cultural than anything else, with some religious overtones in various cases. But Asian countries, I have great difficulty communicating accurately with. and the foundation of their educational and learning system is so different than Western. We got to dig a little deeper if we're going to figure out how to have better East-West types of conversations and looking for mutual solutions for humanity as a whole. Because there's going to be different approaches for different cultures.
Absolutely. Now, in your opinion, is disinformation more powerful when it feels native than rather foreign? Like people would listen in their own language A, and it's native, meaning that it wasn't produced via synthetically via another product or something.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, AI has gotten pretty damn good at translating stuff. The word we used to use is translation versus localization. How colloquial can you get the phraseology to do? And it's getting better. I use it once in a while because my French sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. It's always fun to watch because Latin, French is the only other language I really speak. And the subtitles, and you're watching something, and go, that's not what they said. So again, I'm going to go back to culture. An AI is going to put stuff out there. Your job as from a technological standpoint is to filter out as much of the crap as you possibly can ahead of time. And then your job as a human being is to filter out the rest of the crap. And I do not use the word disinformation because that term has been weaponized by certain people in various political communities. And when you look at disinformation, misinformation, what's the difference between that and hoax, clickbait, overly promising? So I put everything under the now academically acceptable term of bullshit.
That's right.
And there are some very good academic treatises on these by some people
I've been in touch with. I love that. Academically acceptable. I love that.
And so in most of my work, I just use BS, put it all under BS, because I don't want I am not going to sit there and do a semantic argument with you and try to parse it at that level of what all these various categories of BS are. But we all know what they are, but the fundamental key is how good is your BS detector?
And so, you know, I'm reminded by the fact that somebody said that to me a long time ago. You know, the most effective manipulation never feels like manipulations. If it feels like manipulation, it's easy to detect. People will find out immediately about it. But, you know, the most serious one, it never feels like it's a manipulation.
Well, that goes back to the Pearl Harbor. We didn't feel Pearl Harbor at all. We ignored the sensing technology that we had of the detection reaction mechanisms, such as they were in the day. Said, no, that's just a blip. Ignore that. And it was what we would call in the cyber world, probably close to a low-land attack.
True.
So I look at them all very, very similarly. And so one's kinetic, one's cyber, one's cognitive. Okay, let's continue from there because they're very, very similar.
Yeah. Now, I know you mentioned in some other content that you've published that you said human risk has overtaken technical risk, mm-hmm. which is true.
Yes.
I mean, in a variety of theater, in a variety of contexts. And, you know, I have a technical background. I always call it the problem between the keyboard and the chair. So there is some of that. But why have organizations been so resistant to that idea? And I've seen a few, and I'm sure you've done.
I've been in the security awareness business, as you know, for many years, and did it for the military. I mean, for all these groups around the world. And then got out of it with selling the company and decided to start looking at other areas. Some of the questions come up, and number one, do we need it? Do we need it? Let's go back to 1992. Do I need to connect to the internet? Similar question. Do I need to train my employees? Why don't they just listen to me? Why don't they just do what I tell them to do? And these were a lot of the arguments in early security awareness, the evolution of that industry. So the other problem is the efficacy and of the metrics. How good are the metrics and what do the metrics really show? So the EFH Institute out of Switzerland did a study, I guess, 3-4 years ago, and it said security awareness training really doesn't accomplish much other than a tick box. Okay, is that true? Well, security awareness companies are going to argue that they reduce it 93% or whatever their numbers are. I am openly questioning both sides of it, because I think that any sort of training is better than having none at all. To say that your folks are trained and they're now going to behave, I think is a foolish interpretation or expectation. And I don't think that we have from a, and I hate the word training, but from that standpoint, security awareness training, we're not doing enough, or we haven't learned yet how enough to create it such that we're modifying the habituation of the participant versus trying to change their cognitive front end. Because we have two sets of brains, the one we think with and the one we react with.
I'm sure you've seen the statistics before, but 2024, 2025, 90 to 98% of cybersecurity incidents were blamed on social engineering tactics.
Sure. Yeah, whatever the number is, the numbers have floated around. Yes, it's always been above 90%.
But social engineering is the gateway. I mean, back to your training question, your training comment earlier, that's how they're manipulating the system. So yeah, you build a firewall, you build your infrastructure, because companies do this, you know, when you have a security threat or security problem, they throw infrastructure at it. They put more dollars into hardware, software, whatever else they need to buy.
And more complexity and an inability to tell what the hell is really going on.
Meanwhile, the gatekeepers for everything is your staff, your employees who have direct access to those systems.
Yep. We're in violent agreement on that. And so social engineering, has it morphed into cognitive warfare? Yeah. Cognitive warfare in many ways, I can say, has been there for, go back to Germany. You know, as a recent example, that they changed the mindset politically of an entire population willing to commit to what happened. Machiavelli. You look at all, go back to history, and you go back into the, even the Egyptian empires, and there were always, how do I control a population to do my bidding? And the argument I use today is, he who controls the technology controls the narrative. He who controls the narrative controls your belief. And that, I think, is more true today than ever because of the force multiplying effects and lack of guardrails in the technology that distributes too much information.
Yeah. Now, here's a tough one for you. Can cognitive defense be systemized, or is it inherently personalized?
There's not enough research, not enough studies on this. I've read tons of studies on trying to do pre-bunking of what they call misinformation. A lot of this work came out of Cambridge, doing some magnificent work out of their psychology labs. And the question that I've asked them is, how does the efficacy of your programs, how do they work over time? Because if you look back to the Ebbinghaus curves of education in the 1860s, the learning curves have not changed. They are still fundamentally the same. And it's the learning curve, the forgetting curve, whatever term you want to use. What creates habituation? And habituation in our sense of life is, I can drive while I'm talking to somebody. How am I doing that? Or I'm on automatic pilot. Well, how do you create automatic pilot to have a bullshit detection system in your high-speed emotional response mechanisms? That does not exist, to the best of my knowledge, at scale yet. I don't think there's been enough experimentation. And a lot of what I've been writing about and talking to people about is, we've got to get funding into these studies to understand. Because right now, going after one person at a time is another recipe for failure.
That's right. Absolutely. Now, for those who are listening who are in a CEO position, or operators, small entrepreneurs, you know, even large companies who are in managerial position or executive position, they're listening to this and saying, no, disinformation is just a political thing, or as you called it, misinformation. There is, you know, I think there is an economic factor to this. Who actually pays the price when the trust collapses?
Ultimately, at the end of the day, the man on the street. Joe the plumber and you and me, ultimately. Organizations are having a difficult time, understandably so, realizing that their organization, their entity, their enterprise, whatever term they want to use, is a cognitive entity as well. And that cognitive entity is made up of all of its constituent parts, which are its employers, its contractors, all of the people that keep that engine running. I, as a bad guy, I know this. Now, that makes it easier for me to design attacks against the big cognitive, big C, by going after all the little C's and by creating. Now, in the financial world, those little C's could be investors. They can be the people on Wall Street. We've seen what happens with blips and accidents that have occurred, just complete accidents. We've also seen what happens when manipulation of the markets have occurred in certain cases. Massive blips that occur for a few trading cycles and that's it. Organizations need to realize, no matter how big or small they are, that they are a cognitive entity that needs to be defended as well.
Do you think, I'm reminded, as you mentioned this, and I was, you and I are having this discussion, when I was a young kid, I was a teenager, I was working in Nicosia in Cyprus, and I was working for a company that produces commercials for big brands. We used to shoot commercials for soft drinks and, the big brands that you know about. And the owner of the company, he was much older than me at the time and, brought me in, and I was working with the team there. He's just like, felt very sorry for me or something. I don't know. I was a young kid running away from the civil war in Beirut. And so he used to tell me, and I always this ring in my head. He said, "Robin, we make commercials for stupid people." And I didn't know what he meant by that. But then one day I asked him, I said, "What the heck do you mean by that?" He said, "Well, if a product is good enough and it's excellent, why do I need to, put a better image for it outside? It should sell itself. If a product is good, people should know about it." Now, things have changed since the 1980s, and obviously now we're in a different world, and, people need to tell about what they're working on, and that's not the case at all. But there is some truth to the fact that taking a product or taking a service or taking something and putting a different layer on it, different package on it, then it's what truly is, and nobody out there willing to tell the truth. No, listen, you're going to buy this fridge, but guess what? You're going to have a repair guy at your doorstep every second week, even though it's brand new, but we're going to tell you it works the best now. Do you think this is a manipulation?
Look at the work by J. Walter Thompson that goes way back, almost 100 years. Advertising is the capitalistic version of propaganda. Yeah. It is. And new, improved Tide, I don't know whether it's new, improved, unless I do the chemical analysis and I look in, because I am, as the geek, I trust nothing. Oh, we have a better firewall. Yeah, probably bullshit. We got better Tide. All right, maybe my clothes are clean enough. I'm good. But that's somebody else's worry. Claims require evidence. And we are in an evidence-free society right now. Some people call it post-truth. But I'm looking at it as evidence-free. People don't care about evidence and examining it. And that is part of the disconnect between our aware minds, our conscious minds, and our subconscious minds. And which one is running you?
So do you believe that trust has become a finite resource?
I don't know what that finite trust would mean. I put trust on a scale, like I do most things, an analog scale of greater than zero and less than one. I do not go for absolutes. I don't believe in absolute anything. I don't think that there is zero trust. Otherwise, we would not exist. You got to eat. You're having a level of trust just for your basic human survival instincts that you're not going to get poisoned. So everything is somewhere in the middle. The issue is provenance. Where does that information come from, and how much trust does it deserve? Has it earned? Now, digitally, there is some work going on, and let's go to stolen paintings of Germans, World War II. The provenance of paintings, there was a 30-year period where the provenance of some masters' artwork disappeared, and the provenance and the art historians had to go back and find out, where did this really come from? Who owned it through? Is it real? And we have this in coins and collectibles and a lot of issues. We don't have it in information yet. But if we had, for example, every piece of source material. So, all right, so I'm going to do a video, out of here, right? It can have provenance built into it with an integrity checker, and we could have a blockchain-like type of mechanism to verify the authenticity and provenance step by step. So Steven Spielberg is out filming a movie. He's doing the original stuff. Cool. That should have, and I'm using the word water, not watermark, that's wrong one technically, but an ID, non-modifiable ID. Then it goes to the Foley Studios and adds another ID. Then it goes through here, another ID, through the whole process. I don't see another way right now for digital provenance. With what we're doing, we need to have an entirely different global mechanism by which to judge the content, to have a better handle on how much BS is it.
That's right. And you know, I hear you talk right now, and I'm reminded also by how many companies have I come across in my career that says in their logo, in their tagline, it says, "Trust us." You know, they sell things based on trust. And then when you and I are talking right now, I'm thinking like this is a very thin layer of selling proposition that could dissipate. Like it's got no solid ground, it sounds like.
I've done this on a personal level in a lot of audiences. And audiences are heavily on the male side, right, wrong, or indifferent, but they are. And so I'll ask a question. How many of you trust your spouse? And everybody puts their hand up. How many of you trust your spouse? One, a few hands go down so you can see where the divorces are coming. Cool. How many of you believe, trust your wife not to have you killed if she was offered $1 million or $10 million? Absolutely. Would you believe the same thing if your kids were in danger and she had to make Sophie's choice? That creates an emotional realization, a small epiphany that no matter how much you think you have trust, you got to regauge it. It's a slippery slope. It is not an absolute.
It's not an absolute. You're right. And you know, there's many professions out there. There's many jobs out there that says in it. You know, I've used that before. Is your I trust you as the last job you've delivered to me. If I'm happy with the last job you delivered to me, we all have short memories nowadays. You know, we only remember if you do 100 jobs for somebody and you do 100 jobs very good, accurately, and then you miss that last delivery, let's say you're in whatever profession you're in, your customer's going to remember that last delivery that went wrong versus the 99 you've done right. And that entire trust that you've built over time, it completely poof, went away in some cases.
The trust will be degraded. And that's why in my other book, Analog Network Security, there's the entire principle is trust degradation over time, whether it's in cyber systems, kinetic systems, or psychological systems. Trust degrades over time, and it's the entropic equivalent in the cyber world and mental world. It's just a different way of looking at things. So trust, it's a very fuzzy slope.
That's right. Now, when you say time-based security, can you, I know you referenced time-based security before, and can you first explain to us what is time-based security? Why is it time-based?
Starting with the kinetic world is really kind of where it came from. I was, the whole thing began in a bar in Warsaw in 1995 with a
bit buddy Warsaw, of mine. Lovely city.
From a buddy of mine from the DOD at the time. And we were sketching napkin drawing stuff. And we got talking about how do you protect? Can we actually protect this cyber stuff? And so I went to a physical model. I said, let's imagine this. There's a jewelry store. You're the bad guy. And there is the jewelry store. And that jewelry store has got millions of dollars in there and all of that. But you also know two things. You know they have an alarm system, which is a detection mechanism. You also know at the end of that, they're going to call the rent-a-cop or the cops or whoever. The bad guys measure it. And we see it in the movies. We got 90 seconds. 60 seconds because they know the response time of law enforcement or whatever their reaction mechanism is going to be in the kinetic world. We never looked at it that way in the cyber world. We tended to say, we got a firewall, we're good. Well, how long is the firewall good for? How much beating on does it take? Well, how fast can you detect if somebody is beating on the door, really? All of these questions started arising. And in the kinetic world, it's, I'm going to say 3 minutes, picking a number. The bad guys know that they have 3 minutes to go in and get as much money as they can and then get the hell out before the good guys come. When we look at it from a mathematical standpoint in the cybers, we can come up with some pretty darn good answers as to the vulnerability because your detection mechanism and your reaction mechanism defines your exposure in the time domain. Your bandwidth shows how much extrication can occur, and it gives you a good solid model based upon time and vulnerability and risk. And that's where it all came from.
That's where it all came from. Here's another one for you. In the art and science of meta war, you argue we are entering a permanent state of reality conflict. Is there an end game or is it a new baseline?
I don't know. Do you believe George Orwell?
A little bit.
Yeah. One of the examples I use to get people to understand this is we all have our big screen TVs at home. And so you got a beer or a Coke and some chips and a wife or a whatever, right? And you're watching this incredible movie. At what point do you become aware you're no longer part of this reality, you're part of that one? The answer is you don't know. The only thing that you know is when you leave that reality and return to this one. When you go to pick up this, when you go to grab this, when you go to do something that is outside of that reality, there is a complete reality shift in your mind. And when you start examining your experiences and thinking of them as reality shifts, it's about attention. How much attention and focus are you putting on a specific experience? I, as the bad guy now, want to screw with that so I can command your attention. Advertising, freebies, emotional, all of those things that affect our behavior and response. But it is about reality distortion. I have sat in groups of 2,000, I've said, everybody close your eyes. And then I turn on a little deeper voice. And I say, we're going back to Greece, 600 BC. You're in your toga, sitting around a fire. And Homer is telling you the tales of brave Ulysses. And I go on for maybe 30 seconds like that. Then I snap them awake. And I said, how many of you were totally part of that? Roughly 80% if I'm doing my job right. I'm creating another reality based upon immersion and control of your sensory organs.
Wow. This is very powerful. So what does victory mean in the cognitive war then?
I don't know.
How do we know?
Victory to me, and I'm making this up because I've never been asked the question, is where I retain control over my identity. I retain control of the get into another reality, leave another reality. If I put on my VR headsets, well, they don't really do much for me because they're so freaking uncomfortable. So I'm always aware that there's something going on.
I bumped into a few tables, by the way, yes.
So it's to increase my mental immune system, to strengthen it to the point where I'm not overwhelmed with too much information, which will automatically distort my perceptions of reality and my reactions, but where I retain full agency of my mental processes. And I think I would call that victory.
Do you think ethics will survive and be competitive in a pressure in a world that is full of pressure and AI-driven systems?
That who will survive?
Ethics.
No.
I mean, ethics pretty much disappeared from the noise that you and I are talking about, which is the internet noise.
If there were ethics, there wouldn't be Facebook.
Why Facebook?
I'm picking on them because of the amount of noise that comes through their channels and the amount of public statements that Meta and Facebook have made over the years regarding their primary goal is engagement. They don't care how they get the engagement. But we also know that negative messaging engages much higher than positive engagements. We know that scare tactics engage very high and are communicative as a disease, much more so than good messaging. That bad messaging and hostility, we react much better to it because it's part of our System 1 survival mechanism. And that kicks in before our cognitive awareness does. And so since their business model is based upon that, I have trouble with that.
Fair enough. So if you were to advise a government or CEO today, what is the one blind spot that worries you the most that you want to tell them about?
The one blind, I'm going to stick to at this point, the overarching issue that this is a thing. The number of podcasts and number of things that I've had the interest that has been coming and ramping up in the last couple of years on this, and the aha moments, the eureka, oh my God, I didn't realize moments, really show how little this message has been getting out over the last few years or dozens of years, depending upon, unless you're part of the government, psychological operations, propaganda, you know, that world, because it's all been part of that for a long time, but now it's being weaponized against you and me and everybody much more profoundly than ever before. So awareness and the will to do something.
And here's the last one before we close off. If leaders continue to treat cognitive security as someone else's problem, what breaks next?
You want me to get crazy?
Let's go crazy.
One of the things that when I've used the cognitive Pearl Harbor example, and as I've been evolving it, the book isn't ready. None of it's ready. It's all kind of fomenting and putting put together. I was asked, what is the most brashest example of a cognitive Pearl Harbor you can come up with? And I go the admission and acceptance that non-human intelligence is real and not a damn thing we can do about it. We're not at the top of the food chain anymore, and you got to rethink everything. And that's going to affect 8 billion people. That's going to affect every institution from supply chain to religion to politics. And I think that is the biggest cognitive Pearl Harbor I could think of right now.
You know, this is a fascinating conversation, Wynn. I never had one of those conversations on this podcast before. 160.
What, fascinating?
Episodes. Very fascinating, actually.
Thank you.
No, this is very good. You're on to something that nobody else has talked about before. And for the audience who wants to reach out to you or participate in what you're doing, I know you get speaking engagement, etc. How do they find out more?
All right. Well, number one, they got to go out and buy my book. And it's not so much that I want the money, but my grandson really likes Lego. And Lego is expensive. And now they're going to put another tariff on Lego because of Denmark, Greenland. Oh my God, whatever. Book, The Art and Science of Meta War. There's some technical stuff, but most people agree that it's a good foundation. One of the big values, in my opinion, there's roughly 700 references in it to source material, additional resources, who's working on what. So obviously that. Take a look at the Cognitive Security Institute. It's a nonprofit organization. I'm one of the directors of it. So again, no money. I'm pouring money into it. It is putting together organizations, corporate memberships, individual memberships to get the conversation going with a strategic center of gravity. Those are really important. If somebody cannot find me, that's their problem. My email, my website, winschwartau.com. I don't hide. I may not respond right away because I get an awful lot of messages, but I don't hide either.
Yeah, for the listeners who are interested in this topic and want to find out more about it, if you can't get a hold of Wynn Schwartau for any reason, get a hold of me. I have his contact information. I'll direct you to him. I'll facilitate an introduction. Happy to do so as these introduction requests come through. Wynn, I want to thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. Any last comments before we...
Yeah, I like this because you asked really smart questions. sometimes I end up in a podcast, they go, what do you think? It's like, no, that means that you haven't read a damn thing. I mean, I really enjoy it when I'm having a fireside chat with somebody who has some knowledge of the topic versus just a black hole tabula rasa and I have to fill all the blanks. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I really appreciate having you on the podcast. I appreciate the conversation we've had together. For me, I've learned a lot.
So have I. I make a lot of shit up as I go along.
I don't believe it. But I do believe one thing, that you know what you're talking about. You're an expert in your field. And for those listeners out there, this is a very important topic. You know, I read it before and I keep telling you guys, 90 to 98% of cyber attacks are social engineering, meaning that they play on the emotion, they play on the behavior of individuals, and they find a way to cause damage to either the company you work for or the institutions you work for. Take a look at what Wynn has talked about today. Buy the book for reference, the Meta War book.
And the Art and Science of Meta War.
Yes, that's right.
And it's in Kindle too. So.
And Kindle, you can have a Kindle. I think it's an audiobook too, isn't it?
No, it's hard to do an audiobook when you have so many images and charts.
References, yeah. But I do appreciate you on the call today, Wynn. Thanks again. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for listening in to the podcast episode 160 today. I thank you so much for sharing and liking the content. Again, all the podcast streaming platforms are available to you. You can download the podcast on any streaming platform. And also, you can view us on YouTube. And I just want to call your attention to one thing is, beside the long form interview that I publish, I do also publish close between 25 to 30 highlighted short videos of each conversation that goes on YouTube as well. Feel free to check those out. If you don't want to listen to an entire 1 hour conversation, somebody probably don't want to listen to 1 hour conversation, I do publish a summary blog post. It's on my blog post site called RobinAyoub.com. You can reference, you can go check the previous episodes as well. And this one will be up shortly as well, right after the episode gets edited, etc. So thanks again for listening in. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. And I look forward to seeing you at the next episode. Wait, don't go away.